Okay, we're back with part two of our conversation with Paulina Borsuk, the author of Cyber Selfish. I'm John Rieger. Paulina, you found your way to writing about technology by an incredibly unlikely path. Seriously, it's biopic material. You say it was like being dyslexic and discovering that you could weld. Tell us some of the story.
Some of the story.
The good parts.
The good parts. What good parts? I was shot in the head when I was 14, and I suffer from permanent, moderate traumatic brain injury. And even though I'm very yappy and very verbal, there's so much I can't do. My brain just does not work. So a mutual friend of ours, when I was floundering and thrashing and thinking I'm not good for anything, introduced me to a small software company in Mill Valley where he thought, well, maybe you can do some technical writing. And I could. And I cannot tell you what joy that was for me. I'm good for something. I will have a career. I can support myself because something about, weirdly, the training I'd had in psycholinguistics and philosophy, John, made it so it was easy for me to understand these kind of symbolic transformations, translating technical concepts in ordinary language. I mean, my undergraduate degree turned out to be good for something. So I love this because I could support myself. And then I ended up at a couple different technical companies where I was doing technical writing. From there, I got recruited to go to New York. And then I ended up in a magazine called Data Communications. And the beauty of that was I got that job from an ad in the New York Times, which would never happen now. And there was probably one person in all five boroughs of New York who had both writing background and knew about computer networking, because the last job I'd had at a software company was in the network division. So that's why I got that job. And that was a fortuitous job to have. One, I learned how to write and be a journalist, and they did a lot of on-the-job training, which would never happen now. But also, I was there at the beginning of a lot of things. I went to the press conference at the Waldorf Astoria where Bill Gates announced Windows. I went to the first conference on the coming commercialization of the internet.
What year was that?
1987.
Whoa.
So not because I was hip or cool, I just time, place, you know, I was there. And so, and me being me throughout all this, you know, yes, there was bits and bytes and speeds and feeds, and that was my job. But I was also always paying attention to the people, which always interested me more than the bits and the bytes and the speeds and the feeds. And I think also what kind of immunized me against a certain kind of gee whiz attitude towards this is I think infrastructure is great. I'm really at home with engineers. I grew up in that Caltech JPL culture. But
in Southern California.
In Southern California. But the things that make me go, oh my gosh, was like, you know, admiring Haskell Wexler's cinematography. Or, you know, those are the things that make me go nuts. It's not like, you know, this new Wonder Widget does this great thing. I can go, oh yeah, I appreciate it. I could see there are people that would really love this, but it doesn't move me in the same way. I'm not hostile to it. I'm not a Luddite. Well, that's slandering Luddites. I don't hate it, but it doesn't move me in the same way. And I think that gave me a permanent sort of, okay, that's nice, but attitude about all this.
So you've got some kind of immunity to the shiny new thing phenomenon.
Yes, very much so. Part of it is, you know, I was... When I was in summer camp, one of my counselors said to me, he said, oh, you're just a nonconformist. So I think I've always had an allergy to the received wisdom or what you're supposed to think and feel or cult personalities or anything. I just think I'm wired that way, you know, bad attitude from the beginning.
If it's all right for me to dwell on the beginning of your story just for a moment, I understand from previous conversations that your survival of that gunshot to the head was a small medical miracle.
Even beyond that, it wasn't even a medical miracle. It's just, it was a miracle of the trajectory of the bullet.
No.
It's not anything they did. It was just the peculiar thing of my head was in motion. The angle of inertia of the bullet. It was a bullet that didn't tumble or hadn't yet started tumbling. It was a miracle of timing, actually. It wasn't, I didn't have some brilliant intervention by a great neurosurgeon. And as my nephew, who's a surgeon, said to me, he goes, your case is actually not very interesting medically because I didn't do anything.
Jerk.
Yeah, true. But he was speaking from the medical point of view because the only medical intervention I had was having my jaw wired shut. It broke my jaw. And that was it. The rest was just, you know, a lot of brooding, but that's what I always do.
Well, I'm glad as your longtime friend that you got both your jaw and most of your brain back in action.
I would say I didn't get most of my brain, but I got some of it back.
You've been a tech skeptic at some level in your heart of hearts, perhaps, for years.
That's right.
So still in the 1980s, you say you began to notice what you call the sacralization of technology companies and software developers. How did that sit with you? What did you mean by that, and how did you feel about it?
As I said, I could never join any religion. And so I began to feel like there were these religious overtones and also these sort of, the gee whiz thing just is not in me. I just don't have it. I mean, again, I could admire a really great piece of art or piece of music. I mean, that's maybe what I long and aspire for. That's what I'm wired for. So I began to see this sort of, not as bad as it get in the 90s, but this sort of this will change the world attitude. And certainly Steve Jobs and Apple really contributed to that. So
we use religious words to describe these people. We call them evangelists.
That's right. Guy Kawasaki was the first evangelist for Apple. And I remember the audition piece I did for this magazine I worked for in New York very briefly. It was about – it was for somebody's use of the Apple II to design – it was a home weaver to design weaving patterns, you know. You know, and this was like in 1984, and the person was...
That's actually pretty cool.
Yeah, it was, it was the Apple II, and I thought this was great, but I didn't have this, oh my gosh, this is the coolest thing since sliced bread feeling about it. I thought, huh, that's a useful tool. That's nice. I mean, what I feel for me is that I can't type. I have terrible writer's block, and I'm really grateful that word processing exists because I would not have had a career as a writer unless I could backspace and light. So I have my things that I'm grateful for. I'm really grateful for online communications because I've spent a lot of my life being housebound and chronically ill. So being available to connect with people online has been very valuable to me as a sick shut-in and also to do my work. So it's not like I hate it all. It's just they're tools. I actually am more impressed with things like modern sanitation and drinking water and, you know, modern systems of heating and cooling. I mean, those things, I think, really changed the world in a certain way.
I know a person who asked his grandmother what the greatest invention of the 20th century was, and she said the electric washing machine.
Particularly true for women. I think that's really true.
Yeah.
I think that that's really true. And, you know, I'm old enough, and my father was a doctor like yours, and he talked about when he was growing up in Toronto, there were still people you saw, you could still see people walking with what's called psoriasis, which is a peculiar kind of neurological mess up you get from having tertiary syphilis. The fact that that's gone, I mean, I look at things like that, those are the things that blow my mind, and vaccines. And, you know, I'm old enough, and so are you, that I had friends in elementary school who did get polio. You know, they just had a shriveled arm. They weren't stuck in an iron lung.
Right.
So those are the things that to me were, not that these are the things that didn't change and all change the world in all kinds of ways, but that's the stuff that I think I really revere.
So turning back to the tech field and your growing involvement with it in the 80s and early 90s, was there a moment when you said, hey, wait a minute, they're treating this like some kind of religion? A moment when that evangelism, that sacralization really leapt out at you?
I think it was my involvement with Wired magazine. I had a wonderful relationship with them early on because they were treating technology as culture, which I totally agreed with. And they gave me a lot of room to write. They gave me great creative freedom. They're very supportive of writing about technology, literary way. It was a great fit initially. And I was being a little, what's the word, in denial, which is their utopianism. And then I realized wedded to libertarianism, I didn't share, but it didn't matter. I could still write a wonderful sort of field report about the culture of the Internet Engineering Task Force, the wonderful guys who create the technology infrastructure of the net. They are fascinating. They let me do stuff like that. They let me write humor pieces. I did profiles because they sort of figured out I was good with people. So I didn't really sort of get what was going on for a while. Or I thought, you know, big tent, they can be like that. I can be like me. We all get along great. I feel very appreciated as a writer. People seem to really respond to what I do. So it's only when it began to creep up on me that, wait a minute, they're getting more and more hardline on this political tangent I do not agree with. And that's what it began to hit me. And then also, I'm sorry, I shouldn't do this. Don't speak ill of the dead. God, did Barlow rub me the wrong way.
That would be John Perry, Barlow.
Yeah, he so rubbed me the wrong way in so many ways. Part of it is, and I share this with you, John, is that he obviously, like me, was the recipient or victim of a really great liberal arts education. And so for people like you and me and him, we have that as a toolkit to draw on all the time. So his rhetorical tricks, I go, eh, I can do the same thing. So I wasn't so like smitten with, oh my God, you know, he's so gifted in this response. And I'm not a deadhead. That's the second thing. And also his thinking was so goofy. I mean, he would say things like, well, if members of Congress just get email, we'd have like the New Jerusalem. Are you nuts? Or he'd say stuff like, you know, email is fundamentally a female technology because it's about communication. And I just, you know, he would come out with these things that were so like offensively stupid. And then he'd call me dyspeptic. And I go, yeah, I proudly own that. And there was the additional thing. He was one of these. There was a real boys' club mentality. And, you know, a lot of them are associated with the now notorious literary agent John Brockman, who was part of the Epstein coterie. And a lot of these guys got big book advances because of Brockman. And there was the reality club. Well, we're just going to sit around and pontificate because we're really smart alpha males and you're stupid. There was this whole whiff of bad juju coming off of all of these guys. And then with Barlow, and he wasn't the only one, he was very much, you know, you try to score with any attractive woman in his vicinity, let's put it this way. And fidelity is for dweebs. And then also, and this is a certain kind of guy, which, you know, we always hear about sexual harassment and all the bad things that men can do to women and retard their career development and everything else. But you don't hear about so much are the men that if they're not attracted to you, they're not interested in anything you have to say. You're just invisible. You're in a meeting, you're in a conference or whatever. I'm not attracted to you. I'm not going to listen to you. And that is a peculiar kind of personality. He had that with me. So it's like, I'm not attracted to her. Why should I listen to anything you have to say? It wasn't stated, but I could feel it. So I do talk about too bad he's dead, because I could say, hey, John, how do those wacky ideas of yours work out, huh? But he's
right. Now that he's dead, you can never win the argument.
I can never win the argument.
But what you describe reminds me so much of the late 60s, particularly around the Whole Earth Catalog, access to tools.
All those
movement.
Guys. And Stuart Brown was very much involved with that. And he was involved with these people. I mean, you know, they were all intersecting and scratching each other behind the ears. And the Well, which is, you know, where I still get my email address, was the virtual community, and Stuart Brown was behind it. I mean, there was a lot of overlap with that thinking. And
I mean, there was real utopianism there mixed
course.
With some incredible obtuse blindness.
Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. And, you know, part of what immunized me against this is I spent 2 years in Madison, Wisconsin, 70 to 72, and I was hanging out for a while with people that we would call radicals.
Were you there when they bombed the math building?
Mm-hmm. And they were Weatherman-type radicals, without getting into what we mean by that. And, you know, like I was eating brown rice to Jerry Rubin. That tells you everything you need to do. Okay. Oh, yeah. So, me being me, I was looking at all this and I thought, huh, this is just like high school. The alpha males get all the girls and don't do any of the scut work. The beta males and the women actually do the real hard work of whatever's involved here. And I thought, I'm out of here.
It's just becoming abundantly clear that you basically know everybody.
Not really.
Can you remember your first encounter with full-blown techno-libertarianism?
I think, strangely, it was at some technology conference I went to in the very early 90s. And I was talking to some guy, not in any romantic sense, just, you know, a guy was working for a company, and we had a conversation, and I was picking his brains about something. And he made a couple of comments that so surprised me, because they were not, again, this sort of New Deal, FDR, Apollo space program, you know, JPL culture I was familiar with. These guys superficially looked like those guys, engineers. But this was a different attitude. And I was so puzzled, I had a reaction of like, huh, well, maybe it's just this one person I'm talking to. But I remember that moment. It was in the early 1990s. Don't ask me which conference it was at.
This guy was like a vendor or something?
Yeah, or a project manager, or, you know, just something. And it so surprised me. I just thought, huh, I should pay attention to this.
This incredibly thoughtful and engaged, smart person that I'm talking to is Paulina Borsuk. She's the author of Cyber Selfish, a critical romp through the terribly libertarian culture of high tech, which was first published 30 years ago?
25 years ago,
and now is having a remarkable and unexpected rebirth. You can look for it in bookstores, I guess, before the end of the year.
September 15th.
All right. Thank you for being here, Paulina.
Thank you for having me.
I'm John Rieger. Bye.